Hello, and welcome to episode 92 of the Sugar Mamas podcast. Today, we are talking about raising a healthy and competent eater, and my guest is Erin Dodge. Erin is a registered dietitian. She's a certified diabetes care and education specialist, also known as a diabetes educator, and she's been living with type 1 diabetes for nearly 30 years. As a diabetes educator, Erin is trained in several of the FDA-approved pump systems, including the automated ones, and as a registered dietitian, she has advanced training from the Ellen Satter Institute, which you're going to learn more about today. As a registered dietitian and a diabetes educator, Erin owns her own business called Dodge Diabetes. So, if you feel like you might need Erin, check out all the links in the show notes to where you can find her on our website at dodgediabetes.com and on social media. She's definitely a fantastic resource for the type 1 community. All right, without further ado, let's get started. You're listening to the Sugar Mamas Podcast, a show designed for moms and caregivers of type 1 diabetics. Here you'll find a community of like-minded people who are striving daily to keep their kids safe, happy, and healthy in the ever-changing world of type 1. I'm your host and fellow T1D mom, Katie Roseborough. Enjoy! Before we get started, I need you to know that nothing you hear on the Sugar Mamas podcast should be considered medical advice. Please be safe, be smart, and always consult your physician before making changes to the way you manage type 1 diabetes. Thanks. I am here with a very special guest today. I'm here with Erin Dodge. And Erin, I'm going to go ahead and let you introduce yourself to the listeners. Tell everybody what your connection is to type 1 diabetes. You have a lot of them. So tell them your connection personally and also professionally.
Good morning, Katie. I've had diabetes. This will be my 30-year anniversary this January. And I had a misdiagnosis and a really high coma for 2 or 3 days when I was a kid. So I've had diabetes since I was 13. And ever since I was diagnosed, I've been teaching my friends, teaching my teachers, family, and relatives all about diabetes. So I just took that natural path and went and got a degree in nutrition, then became a diabetes educator. And I got my first insulin pump in 1999 when I went to college. That tells you how old I am. And man, technology has just changed so much. I know we were chatting before about how far it's come, but it's just so amazing how much we've learned about type 1. We still have a long way to go, but I just love teaching and I love helping other people because my specialty is at Dodge Diabetes. I do one-on-one counseling and I have a group class called Be Your Best Pancreas where I teach people how to be an insulin ninja and how to look at their CGM graphs and figure out trends and any weird variables and things. And I feel like that you're missing that a lot in our 15-minute endocrinology appointments and follow-ups and even with the diabetes educator. So having diabetes, I feel like gives me an advantage to help other people that are struggling. But as a dietitian, I really enjoy, love food. Obviously, my husband and I are foodies. I'm so blessed that my husband loves to cook. So he has a lot of that grocery shopping routine in his court. I'm excited. I have 2 kiddos. I have a 4th grader who's 9 and a 6-year-old that's in 1st grade. So it's an adventure here at the house.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So many things. So you're a registered dietitian, which I love that you said you love food because my sister is also a registered dietitian. And she also she is a rather slim fit person, but she just jokes around all the time how she's the worst dietitian in the world. Cause she goes to work and she works from home now for Teladoc, but she used to work in an outpatient dialysis clinic and she would of course go to work and educate her patients on what they should be doing differently and how they can improve their overall health and nutrition. And then we'd go out to dinner and she'd get some heinously fried item on the on the menu. And I mean, she certainly gets in plenty of healthy stuff too, but she would always joke around about how she's the worst dietitian in the world.
Yeah, loaded nachos for the win.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So I want you to talk a little bit more about Dodge Diabetes, because as a registered dietitian, at least I know with my sister, like she can only treat people in that field in the state that she's licensed in. Is that the case for you? Or is this something different where through kind of your coaching courses, you can get to people nationwide?
Well, a lot of the coaching is like part of, so I'm also a certified diabetes educator, and a specialist. So I have that sort of realm too, as kind of a broad spectrum of things where I can kind of encourage and coach people on insulin and things. So I do have a pretty big following across mostly the East Coast and kind of trickling into out West a little bit now. But I do a lot of insulin pump trainings and really kind of help people that way as well with the technology and devices. And, you know, when you wear all the stuff, it just makes it so much easier to teach people when you're kind of, you know, 24/7 sort of tapped into it.
Yeah, because I want people to know this too, like you're pretty much trained and certified in, is it all of the pumps that are out there? Which pumps are you trained in?
Really, there's only three on the market right now that's FDA approved. And previously, there's been up to six or seven, which I got to wear them all, which is the cool part about my job. But yeah, so I do mostly trainings with Omnipod and a few Tandem insulin pumps here and there. But getting to wear all the devices and learning how the algorithms work, it really helps me be able to help other people that are trying to finagle and finesse those algorithms to really hone in and get their best blood sugars with the technology.
Okay. So there's probably a lot of people listening right now that are like, I need that. I need you. So if people want to find you before we jump into our topic today, where can they go to find you?
You can find me on social media, Dodge Diabetes on Facebook. And then I also have a private Facebook community where a lot of the magic happens with some of my freebie courses and things. And that's the Dodge Diabetes community. And then I also have an Instagram account as well. And then you can go to my slowly building website, dodgediabetes.com.
Yeah, I will link to all of that stuff in the show notes so people will know where they can go to find you, to see what you're all about, and to get help from you if they need it. Okay, so today's topic is a very important one, just in general for parents, like forget about type 1 diabetes for a second, but definitely also for parents of type 1 diabetics. And today we're going to be talking about raising a healthy eater. So I want everybody to know a little bit about your background and your training as a dietitian. I know that just from talking with you for several months now that you're trained, you have advanced training from the Ellen Satter Institute, which if you're in the dietitian world, especially in the pediatric, you know, dietetics world, you're probably very familiar with that name at least. So can you tell listeners who Ellen Satter is and what she's known for?
Ellen Satter is my hero. She started out as a dietitian probably, gosh, back in the 70s. And she practiced as a dietitian doing a weight loss clinic. And to make a long story short, she realized that it didn't work. She would coach these people in these intense weight management programs and give them meal plans and have them scour through their pantry and their kitchens and really be miserable, to be honest, and see a little bit of success, but then to see the weight come back on. And she figured out that the current weight management programs that are out there on the market, only 5% of people who lose weight actually keep it off for more than a year. 5%. And that's a major failure rate in terms of healthcare and in general, the process of things. So she went back to school after being a dietitian and went into psychology and got her psychiatry degree. So now she's a dietitian and a therapist. And what she found was she wanted to test her theory about people's relationships with food and how that correlates with general overall health. And what she found was crazy was that if you're a competent eater and you can kind of feed yourself in a positive way, you enjoy food, you have a structure around your eating, and you take time to nourish yourself, that your outcomes are drastically better in all aspects of all health. So that would be cardiac risk factors. Your weight is in a more normal range. You're overall generally happier and don't have a lot of guilt around food. And this measurement that she did was pretty surprising to a lot of the medical community and the psychology side of things as well. And it eventually became adopted by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And so they follow that guideline on how to teach parents how to feed their kids. And we'll go into that in a little bit more about how to kind of be successful with her approach and the division of responsibility.
Okay. Yes. I definitely want to touch on that and the division of responsibility, because I know that's like her big thing. And I want listeners to know about that too. But you kind of use the term competent eater a minute ago when you were saying, you know, she has found that if you are a competent eater and you're good at nourishing yourself and taking care of yourself and listening to your body, then you'll be a lot more successful than trying to restrict. So can you just like, what does it mean to be a competent eater to you or and or to Ellen Satter?
Competent eating is just where you trust yourself to be able to stop when you're full, to eat when you're hungry, and to not have a lot of emotion tied with like guilt or, oh, I shouldn't be eating that, or, and just really be joyful about eating and coming to the table and focusing on so many other aspects of nutrition besides just the calories and the protein and the fat. And I know that's tricky when you have diabetes or you're raising a child that has diabetes, not to just focus on all the nutrients, but more on the emotional side of how food brings us all together and, you know, having that joy around the table.
I know I'm very big on, I mean, we really try to have family meals as much as possible. And we could, you know, we'll talk about that too, because she talks about that a lot in her book. Erin suggested that I read a book by Ellen Satter. She said they're all good, but she said if I was going to pick one to read, this one called Your Child's Weight, Helping Without Harming. And I did. I skimmed some of it, but read most of it. And it was really a great read. I feel like just the title could probably be pretty triggering for some people. To be quite honest, it was a little triggering for me because I was a pretty overweight kid. So I was like, oh geez, what kind of light is this going to shed on things? But what I was going to say is, you know, in my house, you know, we don't follow the Ellen Satter method exactly to a T, and we're going to talk about that, what it is, in a minute. But one thing I do is if my kids are just eating lunch, you know, and they're maybe on a device, like if they're sitting there with their iPad next to them, like playing Minecraft or the phone, I make them get off the screen because I'm like, I want your full attention to be on your food, because I really feel like there's a mental tie to like your experience of eating. It's not just about like shoving calories in your face that makes you full and satisfied. Like I feel like being able to kind of focus on your food and experience it makes you fuller and allows you to kind of remain fuller for longer. And it's like it like registers with your brain more that you've actually eaten a full meal. Whereas when you're kind of doing something else at the same time while you're eating, it's like it almost doesn't register with your brain, or at least with my brain. I know that if I'm scrolling on my phone and eating a bowl of oatmeal, I feel like I'm hungrier an hour later than if I hadn't been scrolling on my phone and eating at the same time.
Yeah, you look down and your sandwich is gone and you don't even remember eating it. And so being more mindful, because your body's giving you constant cues. Mm-hmm. Just like when your kids were babies, you had to pay really close attention or you were going to get the bowl thrown at you or spit at you. And so as babies, we're born with the ability to know how much to eat, when to eat, and sort of that demand. So you're constantly, you know, listening for the baby's cry. And you're, as a mom, you could hear which cry is a hungry cry and my diaper's wet. And so if you can just support and feed in that loving way where you're providing and not restricting, then I think you're going to find that you can create a child that has that joyfulness around the table, that has competent eating skills, and that will eventually grow up with those. That's a huge skill set to be able to have competent eating as an adult. And we all know friends that you go out to dinner with and they like don't like to eat in front of people, or they'll order a salad and just push it around, or they don't really, or they're not in the moment and don't enjoy the food, or they're obsessed with, you know, how perfect their nutritional, like, kind of profile is in their plate, and they don't enjoy it. Like your sister, she goes out and enjoys her dinner. It's not her everyday routine that she does the fried stuff. But again, mm-hmm. you get a lot of joy out of it. You enjoy the company. And it's really sad when people, as adults, they don't have that joy around eating. And we want to have that for our kids as well. So hopefully we'll get to all the details of how you can do that soon.
Yeah, let's do that now, actually. So she, her big phrase that she has coined is called the division of responsibility, which is kind of her method of how to, and by the way, you're the expert. So if I'm saying something wrong, you feel free to stop me and be like, no, Katie, that's totally wrong. But so her, the division of responsibility is kind of her method to get parents to kind of bring back that joy to eating at the table and kind of allow kids to kind of figure out on their own how much food they need and when they need it and whatnot. So could you talk about that? Could you explain to listeners what is the division of responsibility and how she kind of suggests that we put it into practice in our homes?
Right. So the division of responsibility divvies up jobs for the parents when they're preparing the meal and jobs for the infant or the child. So the job of the parent or the caregiver is the what you're feeding, when you're feeding it, and where you're eating it. Okay. And if you can stay within those boundaries of your jobs, then the child will be able to show up at the table and be responsible for how much they eat and whether or not they eat at all. And okay. as long as you don't kind of tiptoe into the child's responsibility, what they found, and again, this is what's supported by the American Academy of Pediatrics on raising a competent, healthy eater, is that the child will grow up to get the body that's right for them. They'll be able to learn cues and push themselves along for hunger and satiety. They'll get a variety of different foods that are sort of introduced to them so they can try different things and kind of develop their palate and taste buds for a variety of different foods. And again, have that joy in feeding and eating.
Mm-hmm. When I was reading through it, like she was talking about how she had all these parents coming to her very anxious and worried because their kid was gaining a lot of weight or just wasn't eating at all at the dinner table. And what she found is that these parents were putting very kind of strict rules around what their kids could eat and how much of it they could eat and just really restricting their diets quite a bit, right? In both in what they're eating and the quantity of it. So she found that, you know, if you kind of take off those reins a little bit, which we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but that can be very scary for the parent of a type 1 diabetic to be like, eat however much of this you want. But she found that as long as the parents brought to the table the food that was being eaten, right? Like the parents got to choose what was being eaten and when, right? The time and where, whether that was at the family dinner table or at a, you know, at a, obviously at a restaurant, you can't choose the what so much because people are ordering from a menu, but.
Or even in the car on the way to soccer practice, yeah. You know, sometimes yeah. it gets crazy at after school activities. So.
Right. So if you show up with the food and basically let your child know, okay, this is what we're eating. You can eat as much of it as you want or nothing at all. That's fine, right? I'm going to let you make that decision. That's where the child responsibility comes in of how much and whether or not. So she found that if the children were allowed to make those decisions about how much or whether they ate or not, then there was a lot more success with getting kids on a healthier path to eating their meals. And then she was finding too that the weight was getting regulated. And I say that cautiously because I don't mean that all of a sudden the kids dropped a bunch of weight, but in the sense that they were now starting to grow normally on the growth chart. The growth chart was showing consistent growth in weight and height. Then that was considered successful.
Right. So anytime parents interfere in the kids' jobs around feeding, mm-hmm. then it's usually results in a negative outcome. And what we found in research is that if you have a heavy child and you try to restrict their food, the child will typically get heavier. Mm. And if you have a child that's underweight that you're trying to encourage and eat, have them eat more and try to add more calories in here and there, that they will typically get thinner. Mm. So it's almost like, I mean, you guys have been parents, you know how how that opposite effect kind of happens psychologically. So they can sense your interference and that you're trying to persuade them into doing something that they just really don't want to do, and they'll fight back. The big trigger and what you want to look for, especially for children who are on the heavier side, is if you're over-restricting, they'll start sneaking food. Mm-hmm. Or if you're over-restrictive with your allowance of some of the not so healthy, like forbidden foods, which we'll go into a little bit down the road, then mm-hmm. you're going to find, again, sneaking food, over-consuming to the point where it becomes more of an issue than it was if you would have just supported your child's eating as they go. Because what we know with kids and their growth is it's not a smooth, perfect growth chart, is mm-hmm. that a lot of times kids will get a little chubby mm-hmm. and then they'll grow like 2 inches mm-hmm. and then they'll get a little chubby and then they'll grow 2 more inches. So you have to trust the process. Mm-hmm. And again, like you said, it's not going to fix itself overnight or even in 3 to 6 to 9 months. And with younger kids, it's a pretty quick turnaround if you can start applying these approaches with the division of responsibility. But for older kids, you're unraveling a lot of things that have been sort of in place for several years. So it may take a little longer to see strides in that competent eating. Mm-hmm. And with the division of responsibility, again, like you said, you sort of offer the foods that you're going to select. So let's say it's, you know, a meat and sides and a glass of milk or a, you know, butter bread or something like that. So your child can choose any combination of those items from that meal that you're serving and eat as much or as little or none of it that they want. The key piece, though, is that you have established structure around that meal. So the worst thing that I see happen with parents is snacking. And if your child's not coming to the dinner table hungry, number one, their behavior is going to be terrible. They're just going to be jerks. Number two, they're not going to be hungry, which means they're not going to eat the items that you've took all this time to prepare. Because let's face it, making family meals is hard work. And when no one eats, it's like the biggest insult ever, you know? And yep. It makes you not want to do it again. It's like, well, that was just a waste. I should have just made peanut butter and jelly, or, you know what? I'm just sort of, and there's nothing wrong with peanut butter and jelly for dinner. But effort-wise, it's a lot of work and a lot of energy to put into preparing meals. So you want your child to show up hungry. So in the structure of feeding, it's typically, you know, 3 meals a day and then maybe a snack or 2 or 3, depending on your child's age. So that after-school snack, you're going to offer, you know, the item that you're going to select, and they can eat as much or as little of it as they want. But and once that snack is over, they can't graze until they sit down at the dinner table. Recommendation is only water between meals or snacks.
Yeah, I had to put this into practice in my own house at some point because, my kids will come home from school and they'll say they want a snack, but then they'll do their homework and they'll watch TV for a little while and then they'll go out and play. And then they come back in at 5:30 when we're going to eat dinner at 6 or 6:30 and now they're ready for their snack. And it's like, well, no, the snack window is closed. And I guess I realized that I wasn't really verbalizing that very well. Like, there is a certain time that I want you to eat a snack and be done eating your snack. And then after that, there's nothing until dinner, because otherwise you're going to ruin your meal. And I, like you said, I worked hard to cook this meal and it took me a long time to think about it and buy the stuff and prepare it and all that. So we kind of had to start doing that. And with Sarah specifically, if we want to look at it from a type one lens, you know, we'll be in the car on the way home from school. And I always ask, what are you going to have for a snack when you get home? And some days she says, I don't want to have a snack. And that I say, that's fine. But just remember that, like, you know, we're not going to be snacking close to dinner. So if you want to eat something, you need to eat it when we get home from school. You know, and then, but most days she does want a snack and she tells me, you know, I just want grapes or something, which grapes are great, right? They're a healthy food and it's one of Sarah's favorite foods. But I try to encourage her to eat a little something more, which, you know, maybe that's the wrong thing to do. But just for the lens of type one, like I want to bolus for the snack and then I want to be done bolusing until dinner. I mean, I'm not opposed to like seconds or thirds at a meal, but with snacking, I don't really want to be just snacking and grazing all the way through the afternoon until we hit dinner. So I try to encourage her, like, hey, what if we added a cheese stick to that, or maybe some pepperoni slices, or try to get her to eat a little something more substantial to carry her through. And so I'm only having a bolus once.
And my kids are starved when they get home, depending on what they had for lunch or what they did during the day. They're ready to eat their arm off. So I think, again, putting the homework down and like focusing on the snack. And even if it's okay, even to set a time frame, be like, listen, finish up your snack. We got to move on and work on homework and do these other things. And so you have 5 more minutes to finish your snack and then we're going to put it away. But what you did with offering the cheese or the pepperoni or whatever else to go with the grapes is perfect. Now, it would be her decision to say, not feeling cheese or grapes, but then as feeding with love, and even with diabetes, you could kind of suggest, hey, let's get the bolus in a little bit earlier, do the like pre-bolus for the grapes. And you can kind of talk her through. And I know you do a great job of being a good teammate with your daughter with diabetes too, and just cheerleading and encouraging. But pre-boluses are tricky. You don't always have that perfect window to be able to do that. You just have to be really careful that you don't tiptoe into her realm of responsibility with the how much and whether. Does that make sense with the timing and dosing?
And I do want to encourage parents too with the how much aspect. Like if I bolused for X amount of grapes and then in the car, and then we got home and I measured those out and Sarah ate them. And then right then and there was like, can I have some more? I personally don't have a problem with that. I have found that if I can get that first pre-bolus in and working the first time around, that, and there's already something working in her system, that it's not necessarily necessary, at least for us, for Sarah, to do another pre-bolus before she has like another handful of grapes. Like I can just give her the insulin then, and she can eat the grapes, and that seems to work well when there's already something working in her system. So I feel like a lot of people get a little panicky, type 1 parents, about that, about the how much, like, oh no, now they want seconds or thirds. And I don't know, I don't know what your experience has been in your own type 1 journey, but I have found that if we can kind of get the insulin flowing first, the second pre-bolus doesn't matter as much.
Right. And now, again, I'm a diabetes dinosaur, and I still remember as a kid being on an exchange list. And for you guys that are newbies, an exchange list was back before, like literally I was diagnosed when food labels just had come out in 1993. And I had a meal plan of, I got one serving of fruit and I got one starch and a meat. And like, so it was a very regimented routine as a teenager. And so I had to eat to match up with my insulin. Mm-hmm. And now, because of all the advancements in diabetes and what we know, we can now match the insulin with the food. You're doing the perfect approach. And now when you're on an insulin pump, that makes life a lot easier if you want seconds. Mm-hmm. What I would tell parents who are on injections is, depending on the age of the child, you can let them decide. You can put the responsibility kind of in their decision court and say, hey, listen, I know you want more grapes, or I know you want another scoop of rice, but we already dosed for this much rice. You can either, and then kind of lay out the options. So you can either eat a little bit more meat and more green beans and not have to take an injection. Mm-hmm. Or if you really want that rice, we're going to have to do another injection. And that gives them the choice and the responsibility in their division of responsibility with feeding, so that they can choose more, but then they realize they have to have that responsibility with diabetes of taking a little more insulin. And just having empathy and letting your child make that decision on their own about taking a shot. Because, I mean, if it's delicious, it's worth an extra injection for me for another 2 slices of pizza or something like that. So you have to kind of give them a little bit more reins. And when they're going through a growth spurt, man, they'll eat you out of house and home. So as much as you try to guesstimate how much they're going to eat, they may surprise you.
I'm definitely experiencing that right now, mostly with my older son who's 12. Oh my gosh, he just eats so much food, which I know that's normal, right? That's that's just normal for that age. But I'm like, oh, we're going to have to increase the grocery budget coming up here, I think. I want to talk too about, you know, just, I feel like people should definitely go look up Ellen Satter's method. I think her philosophy around eating is, I definitely love it. I think that for type 1 parents, it might be a little anxiety inducing at first. And I have a question about that in just a second. I want to come back to it. But I also know that there's a lot of people out there that are going to read it and or hear it and not agree with it and not. I just want to say in the middle of the episode here that like it's not going to be for everyone. Like everything I say isn't going to be for everybody. This is just one method. It's a very popular method. It was adopted by the American Academy of Pediatrics. So it's very, very popular, very well known, highly respected method. But it's also not for everybody, and we might touch on that in another episode because Erin's going to do a couple episodes with me. But okay, so I wanted to go back and say that with the division of responsibility in the book, and this was causing me to sweat a little bit while I was reading it, but as the parent, you provide what they eat. That might mean you have rolls on the table. Like you said, you have steak, you have green beans or whatever it may be, but it's up to the kid to decide what they eat or whether or not they eat. So if they decide they don't want any steak or green beans, but they want to eat five rolls, like she says, let them do that. She says to let them do that, and they will figure out kind of how to navigate that and how to slowly incorporate more foods and increase their palate when it comes to foods like meats and vegetables and things like that. Would you talk about that a little bit and maybe just help parents of type ones ease our fears around letting our kids eat an entire basket of bread?
Picky eating is one of the biggest concerns that moms and parents have around eating. And what we know is that when there's pressure around eating or the one bite rule, or you have to eat this before you can get up from the table, that creates a lot of anxiety in a child's mind around that food. And again, it's almost like reverse psychology. Like there's some reason they want me to eat this, but I don't want to eat it kind of thing. And you know your kids and your family better than anybody else. And some kids dig their heels in way more than others and their personalities. But what they know is that it takes anywhere from 10 to 20 exposures to a new food for a child or even an adult to come around to get comfortable with it and to like it. And so what might seem like to a lot of moms, they said after 3 introductions to a new food, moms chalked it up like, they don't like that. I'm not going to serve that again. Where it actually takes a lot more repetition than you'd actually think to a food for it to become familiar and for people to try it, for kids to try it. And I know even the differences in my 2 kids, like my older daughter is so much more adventurous with food. She's not afraid to put something in her mouth and be like, oh, that's terrible, and spit it back out. But my son is, he will start gagging before it even hits his lips. Like he's already decided in his head. But what they found is that the more pressure you put around eating and trying a new food and adding, again, you want it to be like a neutral sort of playing field at the dinner table to where if they want to try it, they can. If not, they don't. And it's just kind of like, and you have to trust the process. And some kids are going to be more adventurous. Like I said, with my daughter and her palate, she likes a lot more items than my son does, but he's really starting to come around and try new foods and at least let it sit on his plate. Because at one point with green beans, he wouldn't even let it touch his plate. He would set it off to the side, off on his napkin. And now he's getting to where he'll squish it and smush it with his finger. And that's signs that he's coming around to adopting and getting around to liking that new food. So just be patient. And again, if you're serving meat and potatoes at all your meals, then your child's not going to learn to like caviar and sushi. If you're serving and using the division of responsibility, your child will grow up to get to like and choose foods that you already serve and like that are familiar, and then be adventurous to try other things as you push them out of the nest and they go try other families' meals or at other opportunities at restaurants and things.
Yeah, I can definitely speak to that, especially for my Sarah, thank goodness, my type one, she is my most adventurous eater. So she loves all sorts of vegetables and she's willing to try almost anything. My 2 boys, on the other hand, it must be a boy thing, maybe. I mean, maybe not. I'm sure there's a lot of picky girls out there, but they are a lot more hesitant to try, especially my youngest, to try new food. But with my oldest kid, we had to have a conversation in our family a few years ago just about dinner time because it was very stressful for me because like you've already touched on, like I would mentally plan what I was going to buy, go to the grocery store, unload the groceries, prep the meal, you know, then have to clean up the meal. So it was very stressful for me to sit down at the table and have an unpleasant experience. Like, I just wanted to sit down with my family. I did not care what they put in their mouths. Honestly, I didn't care if they ate or what they ate. I just was like, I just wanted, this is our really only time of the day to sit down and have a meal together. I just want it to be pleasant and I don't actually care what they're eating, which I'm sure some parents are listening to that and are just absolutely horrified. But listen, I'm not everybody's cup of tea. That's just me. So I, you know, seeing as the meals were primarily my responsibility, I was like, can we just not care quite as much about what, you know, people are eating? Because I did not like, you know, I'm forcing them to take one bite of something before they could, you know, get up from the table or try everything on their plate before they could get up. Like, that just wasn't my jam. I told my husband, I was like, at this point in time, like, if I can just put broccoli on the table and they can see it and they can identify a piece of broccoli, then I'm happy with that. Like, if they could just know what a piece of broccoli is or know what a Brussels sprout is, like, that sounds great to me. And so we agreed on that just because, you know, it was something that was stressing me out. So we agreed on that. And I will say that over time, just being patient and continuing to serve a variety of foods, but also not care about whether or not those foods were being eaten, because I love leftovers. So whatever's not eaten, I will eat the next day or a couple days after, like, that's fine with me. But I will say over time that, like, especially my oldest son, I mean, he's really starting to get pretty adventurous with what he will eat and what he will try. I mean, he still doesn't love to eat a bowl of broccoli, but, you know, we go out to restaurants and he orders something that's not chicken tenders or a cheeseburger. You know, he's branching out and he's trying new things. And, you know, he's asking for salad now at dinner, where before I would just my husband and I would have salad or whatever. You know, I just wanted to say that so parents would have some hope and just, you know, have the long view, have the bigger picture in mind that it's going to take some time. And certainly shoving a piece of broccoli down somebody's throat is not going to make them love it.
And honestly, the amount of exposures with a neutral, like at your dinner table where you're not pressured, you know, you can take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. When you don't fuss, it makes them more curious and they're more likely to try it sooner and less exposures than if you pressure and you force and you have to take one bite. And it's almost like a mental block that they make where I am never going to like broccoli, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And kids have got some, they're pretty, they'll flex on you big time.
Mm-hmm. They can hold a broccoli grudge for a long time.
And so we don't want broccoli grudges, and it makes dinner time so much more pleasant. It makes the kids excited to come to the table, and family meals are a lost art. And again, just turning the TV off, sitting down together, having a meal, enjoying it, having that conversation is really what kids thrive in, what adults thrive in, and that structure. And they've shown that socially they do way better in terms of drugs and cigarettes and promiscuous actions. And then even the relationship with their family, they eat more vegetables, they do better in school, they have a better outlook just in positivity in general. So it's just amazing how those connections over the week with your kiddos at that family meal can make a huge difference in your relationships.
We don't get to eat a family meal together every single night just because of activities and work schedules and things like that. But we make it a point to do it at least, you know, three nights a week. I at minimum, that would, you know, we really shoot for that. And then, you know, and then there's weekends too, where it doesn't have to be dinner. You know, I think people get stuck in this mindset of, oh, it has to be this dinner, this Publix, beautiful Publix commercial-esque dinner where we're all sitting down together. It could be breakfast. Sometimes Saturday morning, we're all sitting around the breakfast table together and chatting, or I'll come in on a Sunday for lunch from doing whatever we're doing and eat lunch together, just kind of standing around the kitchen counter. It doesn't have to be this formal sit down situation necessarily. And she even talks about it can be, you know, in the, like you said, in the car on the way to soccer practice, or even at a restaurant, which again, it's a little harder to do with the, what you're going to eat of the division of responsibility, but it's really more about the connections that you're having together as a family that kind of helps with kids kind of growing into being more competent eaters.
Mm-hmm. And having that joy around the meal and having it nourish your body. And I feel like with diabetes, we know that there's so much emphasis put on food that it's really hard to enjoy. So you have to make that intentional, especially I think with type one, to make food joyful and not associate it with, oh, I have to take an injection. Oh, you know, there's always a fight around dinner and am I eating the right amount of carbs, and then seeing the numbers and even making judgments about what the sugars do in terms of feeling guilty for eating certain foods. So again, it's just data, it's information, and you want to maintain that joy around eating, even if diabetes tries to steal that joy a lot of times.
Yeah. I'm just curious, like with you being on the exchange diet back in the day, being the diabetes dinosaur that you are. That's a good term. I like it. Did that create some unhealthy relationships with food for you? Like, did you have to kind of undo that over the years, or was it not a big deal?
I think so. I don't know. I was kind of a compliant child. Like, so I kind of went along with the rules, whereas some of my friends that had diabetes would like sneak me, like sneak snacks and foods and things like that. So I think it kind of depends on each child. And again, mamas, you guys know your kids and their personalities the best, but I was pretty compliant with it. But then I remember when it switched over to just being carb counting later in my teen years, it was like, and then I went on the insulin pump, like when I was around 17, it was just amazing to have that freedom and flexibility and not feeling like I had to eat breakfast, lunch, snack, you know, like this regimented routine to match up with my NPH and R. Mm-hmm. And then now I could just eat when I wanted, like a normal kid would. So I feel like I did have a little bit of animosity towards my diabetes, but I felt like it was kind of the rules that I had to follow. But not a lot of kids that resonates with. They'll push back, they'll dig their heels in, you'll have a lot more issues with kids following in that regime and strict rebellious kind of things around food. Mm-hmm. Because no one likes to be told what to eat. Like if you get, you know, diagnosed with some chronic illness and you have to change, like there's a lot of resentment about that, even if it's just something like low salt. So I feel like with diabetes, especially when you're raising and you're learning about food and how it interacts with your body and listening to cues about fullness, it makes it really hard to be successful with diabetes, especially if you're not, if you're getting caught up in the rules so much in terms of, again, you need to match the insulin with the food and not the food with the insulin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So before we wrap up, how, you know, for all the, for the type one parents that are listening, which that's pretty much everyone, that's the vast majority of listeners, I guess just, you know, I feel like people listening are probably think it's a, this sounds a little bit like a free for all, but I promise you, if you read through one of her books or get on her website, I'll leave a link to Ellen Satter's website as well in the show notes. It is very structured. You know, it's giving kids the freedom to eat as much as they want, you know, when you have provided them the food to eat. But, you know, So I feel like, you know, type one parents might hear that and get really anxious, right? Because that can make managing the insulin and the blood sugars and the diabetes a little tricky, but it is very structured. And, you know, I guess I want you to kind of speak into a way that parents could reconcile her method, Ellen Satter's method, that has been very successful and is very, you know, respected and well known, with kind of giving our kids, with also managing diabetes, I guess, without totally unclipping the seatbelt and letting go of the reins and just saying, you know, do whatever you want and we'll fix it later. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I mean, I totally get it, because it's a lot of control that you don't want to let go of, because you just don't want to just let the blood sugars go berserk. Mm-hmm. So I would probably say, and I was blessed to have an amazing mom that she just knew how to follow, like she automatically followed the division of responsibility. But I would say communication and being that team, echoing the team player kind of attitude towards your child with type one, because you're in it together. And so if you can have those open lines of communication, like you're talking about with the grapes on the way home from school, that helps her be a better pancreas by dosing ahead of time. You can kind of get an idea of what we're going to have for snack and kind of get all that stuff lined up. And then, like we were talking about before with communication, like, oh, mom, I'm still really hungry. I want another two pieces of pizza. And then working together to figure out the best plan to make that happen, mm-hmm. whether it's giving another injection, whether it's having more veggies or salad or pepperoni sticks or something else to kind of balance things out, but really still allowing that child to have that autonomy with their job of how much and whether, mm-hmm. Especially during those growth spurts and things as well, or even special events and things like that. I feel like if you can just stay on your tippy toes and do it the best you can most of the time, mm-hmm. and then you can always go back and take correction doses to accommodate for that. And that's another way too, without it being a judgy sort of, I told you so sort of way as a mom or a caregiver, to be like, oh man, I'm sorry your sugar's 300. Maybe next time we should blah, blah, blah. Or what do you think we could do next time that would make you feel not so sick? Mm-hmm. And really kind of troubleshoot together and come up with the idea of how to change it next time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. Because it takes a lot of practice with dosing and especially like with pizza and those challenging foods to get it right. So keeping those lines of communication open so that they don't feel restricted, but that you're a team together in figuring out the dosing as a pancreas.
Okay. So lots and lots of communication and just keeping those doors open. Got it. Okay. So do you use the division of responsibility in your house with your kids?
I do. I do. And it's funny, like I said, my kids are absolutely like very different. Like, mm-hmm. and it's just interesting to see them fall into their personalities and their food preferences and things. And not everybody gets their favorite dinner every night. And so, you know, my son loves cheeseburgers. And so that's his big win. And my daughter likes Caesar salad and spaghetti. So like, everybody will get their favorite meal, and you just reinforce that, you know, we all sat down together and there's going to be something that you like at the table, whether it's the four rolls with butter that they eat or not, but it will push them along to like more foods and to be more adventurous and trying new things and just, you know, finding something they like at that meal. Mm-hmm. If not, they'll just be hungry and then there'll be another opportunity for them to have a healthy snack or something later after dinner, or bring the same meal out again that, you know, they'll know, you know, that they'll eat something else off of that plate too at dinner or at the snack time. Mm-hmm. So they'll have something. If they're still hungry, there'll be another opportunity for them to eat again. You're not trying to kind of play puppet master and manipulate the food kind of in the background, but kids, it's interesting, kids versus adults. So adults will eat stuff because it's healthy for them. Mm-hmm. Kids will not eat anything that doesn't taste good. So make sure that you're, when you're preparing the food, that you're using stuff that makes it taste good. Butter, really healthy, good for healthy brains, dressings and salt and things that make the foods taste better for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I love it. She talked about butter a lot. I'm like, I can get on board with this situation. I love butter.
All those healthy fats, man, that make that brain grow and all those neurons and stuff fire. Yeah.
Yep, yep. Yes. Yep. I was just having a conversation with my oldest son the other day about fat and food, because he was asking me questions about something like, if you didn't eat any fat, would you like just be bones and muscles or, you know, whatever. I forget how he worded it. But I was like, actually, your body requires fat. Like, fat is not a bad thing. I feel like our society has made everybody think that it's a bad thing, but you actually need it to survive. It coats every nerve in your body. It coats your brain. It, you know, you need fat, but there's healthy fats and there's not so healthy fats. And so we talked a little bit about that, but yeah, people, you need some fat. So get some butter, get some real butter.
Here's the butter.
Here's the butter. We're having rolls and butter for dinner. I don't know about you, but these sounds really good. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I know you're going to come back on and we're going to talk about a few other things. I think that was definitely a good start to kind of just raising a healthy eater in general and some ideas for people to think about on how to do that and how to maybe not be as restrictive in their feeding methods. And that sounds scary, especially to type 1 parents, but I think in the long run, it just leads to, like you said, being a more successful and a more competent eater and just having a healthier mindset around food in general as you grow up and become an adult and are managing diabetes on your own.
Right. And I feel like if it feels like a loving way, then that's a good, you know, you're on the right track where you're not restricting or again, the meal times are pleasant. And I would encourage you guys to go to the Ellen Satter website. It's the Ellen Satter Institute and look at that division of responsibility and kind of wrap your brain around that concept. And then what's really great is there's age specific tips and tricks on that website that can show you, depending on how old your child is, what that looks like in terms of letting them choose their snacks. As they get a little bit older, they can choose their afternoon snacks or how you should prepare the food in terms of offering the family meals. And so just different little inside tricks and tips that can help you really embrace and be more successful with the division of responsibility and that approach.
Okay, great. Yeah. I will leave a link to that in the show notes as well as a link to all of your stuff so people will be able to find you. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Erin. Thank you for your time and thanks for coming on today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
All right. You're so welcome, Katie. I hope it can be helpful for all those mamas out there.
Oh, I have no doubt that it will be. Thank you. That's it for our show today. I hope you enjoyed listening. Erin will be back with me next week when we talk about how to handle and encourage our picky eaters. You're not going to want to miss that one. Again, make sure to check out all the links in the show notes. I'll have a link to Erin's website, dodgediabetes.com, as well as to where you can find Erin on social media, including Instagram and Facebook. She has an awesome Facebook group, a great little community on there, and you're going to want to check that out. All right, my friends, I hope you have a fabulous week. I will chat with you soon. But until then, stay calm and bolus on. Bye.